You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Mindy Erlob, and we're going to talk about living with a diagnosis, a couple of diagnoses, actually, when we get to it. So let's do it. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting, Mindy Erlob. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I'm excited. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining me. All right. So I have a couple of warm-up questions. I ask everybody, all of my guests, these questions. What part of the world do you call home?
I live in San Anselmo, California, which is in Marin County.
Beautiful. One of my favorite places, I have to admit. Okay, so what is one of the things that you enjoy or even love about being in Marin County?
I love the fact that it's a progressive area and that we tend to lean left and we tend to lean toward the environment, which is how I roll.
Very cool. I love that very diplomatic answer. All right. Today, we're going to talk about your experience as a carrier for the disease called ALS. And I'm going to try and say it. I copy and pasted the long word. You can correct me. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. You and I are recording this at the tail end of February, and the disease is actually in the headlines this week as we record it. People will be hearing it in June, but an actor from the very famous series Grey's Anatomy has just passed away with ALS. So, but let's start with this question. How old were you when you first learned about the disease, just that it existed at all, that it was out there in the universe?
I've known about ALS since as long as I can remember because my grandfather died of ALS just before I was born, and my mom was still suffering from PTSD when I was born.
Okay, so that is one of the things that I was curious about. So you call your mom Nane?
Nani.
Nani. Okay. See, I was reading it. It's one of those things when you read things that people write, you never quite know how it's going to be pronounced sometimes, right? So Nani. Okay. So one of the questions that I wasn't sure about in this was whether or not she was the first person in your family. But so your grandfather had this and then your mom also was diagnosed with it. How old were you when she was diagnosed with ALS?
I was about 46 when she was diagnosed with ALS.
Okay. And you had an experience. You don't remember your grandfather having it then?
I don't remember it, but you know, I heard about him all the time from my mom and from my aunts. So my mom was one of the many caretakers of my grandfather. So we heard about it all the time.
What was the, I want to talk a little bit about the change in like medical research, because this is a story that spans decades and the science changes a lot during this story. So at some point you go through the testing and you learn that you are a carrier. How were you when that happened?
How old? I was about 48 when I got the genetic results.
And before that, like when you were a kid, what was the sort of knowledge, the sort of like awareness of how of your likelihood of getting it and testing that was available?
Well, there were no genes discovered for ALS until well after my own children were born. So, you know, we just heard about how horrible it was to watch my grandfather Milton go through it. And I didn't know anything about ALS or, you know, its prevalence in my family because we didn't know at that point that it ran in the family.
So it was not, you had no way of knowing that it was going to pass from one person to another. It was not known.
No.
Yeah, so that's a really big change in how it goes to live with it. As I was writing out these questions, I kept going back to that like college dorm room conversation that is like, you know, if you knew that, you know, this bad thing was going to happen, would you rather know or would you rather be a surprise kind of question? You know, that was the question that was going through my mind as I was thinking about this. So you have written a book, and I will go ahead and show it. Ta-da! Called Last Nerve. You were kind enough to send it to me, and I want to say thank you very much for that. Illness, death, and grief, they don't happen in a vacuum. Maybe in a TV show. It happens in an isolated thing. The book, the memoir, is a lot of ways about the incredible complexity of your very modern life as some of these things unfold. I'd love to take you back to the time when you were 44, 46, when your mom got a diagnosis. Can you share with us what your life looked like at that point?
Well, when I was 44 or 46, I had two young kids. They're probably 8 and 10 at the time. And I had a husband who had already had cancer once and he was exhibiting signs of having cancer a second time. And so I was kind of just stepping into the role of caretaker for my husband at that point. My mom started showing symptoms of ALS back when I was about 46. But with ALS, usually a diagnosis takes several years because it's a disease of exclusion. They call it, you know, just a set of symptoms that they are following, and no doctors are really ready to call it ALS until they've ruled out everything else. So even in like 2016 or something, my mom had dropped foot and was starting to drool, and everybody was like, oh, well, she's got lupus or, you know, MS or some other Lyme disease or something like that. And because nobody was thinking ALS and nobody was thinking genetics, that just kind of didn't get discovered.
That is really interesting. And it does, I've heard about that with other autoimmune diseases, other diseases of exclusion. It can take years before you get a diagnosis, which seems really challenging to me as an observer. When I hear about the experience, I sense that that is a very challenging experience. And so with so you were married, you had two young kids, not babies, but young kids. You had already stepped into the role sort of a support or a caretaker of your husband who was going through cancer. And so what I want to talk about next is that often I find or I feel like tragedy and chronic illness and grief, they can take center stage in our lives. Like a lot of other things can be going on and it can just really feel like that is what takes over our life. And actually in the bio you submitted for this show, I noticed that everything in the bio is related to your experience with ALS and the speaking and writing you do about that. But when I was reading the book, the very second chapter actually starts with you, like page like 15 or 17, with you in 1999, having just moved from, I guess, Colorado maybe to LA. And I'd love to talk to you about the younger version of you before all of this happened. When you were younger, like in high school, what were the dreams and thoughts about growing up that young Mindy had?
I wanted to be a writer, actually. I wanted to be a writer. And back in, you know, the early 90s, I was in a band. I played, you know, in an original band. So I was writing music from age 17 to age 25. So I was already a writer, but a different kind of writer at the time.
So as a youngster, you wanted to be a writer, and what were your ideas about life as a grown-up, if you had any? Like, did you have any preconceptions about what you thought you wanted from family, or did you want to move to a ranch with a dozen kids, live in a bus, and travel the country? Did you have any thoughts about that at all? Which, I mean, it's fine to say you didn't. I just am taking you back to the early dreams.
I know what the dreams were that my parents had for me. I mean, I knew that my mom wanted me to marry a lawyer, nice Jewish boy kind of thing. And for me, I couldn't get out of my hometown fast enough. My parents were divorced, and I really just wanted to go out on my own. And I wanted to be, either in screenwriting or advertising or writing novels. I just knew I wanted to be a writer, and I was pretty sure I wanted kids when I was little. I've always been kind of a maternal person. And I knew that I wanted to be passionately in love with somebody, but I never had an actual physical, I didn't have I didn't imagine him in any sort of physical shape. I just, I knew I wanted to marry a man. That was all.
And on the lookout for the great romance of your life, like a passionate sort of relationship.
Well, yeah, and I've always been kind of an artsy fartsy kid, like I sang in chorus and I read a lot and that kind of thing. I wasn't a big sporty person, and it wasn't like I wanted to marry a football player or something. Like, I wanted someone who was significantly articulate and thoughtful enough that, he would make me dinner and potentially sweep me off my feet.
That's a beautiful dream. It's a beautiful dream. All right. So that was the dream. Would you have described yourself as a teenager as a risk-taking, adventuresome person? Because you did move to Los Angeles to start your grown-up life. So, which is a big move.
Yeah, actually, I lived in Denver for 13 years before I moved to LA, and I was a professional musician that whole time. So I would say I lived in a different kind of world than most. I wasn't a sorority girl, I was someone in a band. So, I studied filmmaking and decided to move to LA because I thought that my chances of crewing up were better in LA than they were in Denver.
I think that would still be the path today, actually.
I guess,
I
yeah.
mean, things have changed a lot, and the business of media and film and entertainment is completely different. And in theory, you can be anywhere, but I think that there are still pockets of people who are doing big work. All right. So part of the story is in the book. It is really about your experience as a parent, as a child, as a sibling, as a spouse, as a daughter-in-law. And I have this is a this is a in every interview I do, there is a question where I'm not sure if it's a good question. I always ask it anyway, but we'll see how this lands. So I talk to people about a variety of things on the show, choices, and the role of the different types of caregiving come up a lot. And a lot of people that I talk to are in the situation that has a name now. We call it a name. It's got the sandwich generation name, where you are in the position of caring for children and aging parents to some degree or in at the same time. And so one of the things that has been bouncing around in my head forever, or maybe a little time, I don't really know. I haven't been paying attention to how long it's been there, is whether or not, and this is the question, like whether or not we think that this is like a new phenomenon that like our parents and our grandparents like didn't actually like have to go through. Like, are we new to this as like young boomers and Gen Xers? Or is it that it's always been happening, but we're like not preparing each other and we weren't prepared for the realities of what it would be like to be in this situation? So, like, what do you think about that, having lived through it for quite a bit of time? Do you think that this is something that 100 years ago we would have found people doing the same time, or do you think that, you were ready for it, or did it surprise you?
Well, I mean, 100 years ago, people didn't live much past their They didn't live into like their 70s, 80s, 90s. They died much younger. And also, women were having children much younger. So the sandwich generation looked a little bit different because women might have been in their 30s or 40s when they were in their sandwich generation and not going through menopause like in their 50s in their sandwich generation like they are now. I had my kids in my 30s. My grandparents lived it to almost 100 years old. So it's 100 years ago would have been different. The sandwich generation would have had a lot happened a lot younger when you were had more energy, when you were still at reproductive age, when you weren't dealing with hot flashes and shit like that. Excuse me, but
That's fine.
so yeah, I would say it is a thing now. It's a different thing, and I think, when if we can talk plainly about things like estrogen, estrogen is the great accommodator, and when you don't have the estrogen, then you don't have the, I mean, you can be an accommodator, but it's a little harder.
That is one of the things that we talk about now that maybe they didn't always, although I would love to have gone back to be a fly on the wall of like a knitting circle or a bunco night in the 1970s and see what people were really talking about, because there wasn't as much amplification of private conversations as we have today. So I don't know whether or not like maybe women weren't talking about this with their girlfriends, or if it just didn't get the media attention that menopause and estrogen is getting now. Thankfully, because hopefully our daughters are more ready for it than some of us were now. I do this thing where I call my kids and I'm like, all right, write it down. You don't care about this now, but in 20 years, somebody's going to ask you this question: how old was your mom when? And this is the answer.
Yeah.
I don't know if they pay any attention to me, but I try and be helpful. So I thank you for your candor with that. So would you say that you were, before your, like, so when your mom got sick, your husband had already been sick for, had been through cancer. But when you stared down the view of your life in the moment and realized that you were in the role of caregiving for your spouse and for your parents, did it seem to you like it was something that you were ready for and that you expected? Or did it feel in the moment like it was a surprise?
So I should clarify, my husband actually has had lymphoma twice. He had it once when our firstborn was 1 year old, and then he had a very serious lymphoma recently, about 7 years ago. So I had already been a caregiver to my husband, and my parents were in perfect health that when that happened the first time. The
And
second
the first
time,
time it happened, when he got that first diagnosis, I mean, of course, no one's ever expecting a diagnosis, but the role of caretaker for your spouse when they got sick, did that feel like a surprise, or would it have been on your
yeah,
list
it
of?
did the first time it did. But I had an infant at home too, so I was a caregiver to my child and my spouse at the same time, and we had just moved to the area. So I had no community here, and I knew how to caretake because I was taking care of a baby, but I didn't know I was going to have to hold my husband's head out of the toilet kind of thing. And so that was a surprise. But what's interesting is the second time when it happened, I had a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, and my husband had had pain in his body for like 5 years and had walked around without a second cancer diagnosis. And I had been his caregiver that whole time. And when we got the cancer diagnosis, I was like, well, of course it's cancer. I wasn't surprised at all. And when my mom developed drop foot, I want to say she already had drop foot by the time he had cancer. So she was already quite ill, even though we didn't have the diagnosis of ALS. And so I think what hit me hardest was when she got her diagnosis and I was already caring for my husband. That seemed like it was going to be too much for me. And then I had a kid who went off the rails. And, when you add those three things together, it almost seems like too much for somebody to bear.
Absolutely. And the concept of too much is what I was thinking of when I was thinking about this, because when we are, and not everybody has this experience, but if you are a healthy, able-bodied teenager looking forward to in time, looking down your imaginary timeline of growing up, you have this hypothetical view of what being a grown-up will be. And maybe that includes, you know, for better or worse, sickness and health with a partner, and growing old and all of those things. But I don't know that very many of us have the awareness to realize that it's often like a hurricane, typhoon, tornado of things that happens all at the same time. That's why they write the country songs like that. It doesn't just happen one thing at a time. You know, your car breaks down, you lose your house, and everybody in your family gets sick all at the same time. Not always, but that is definitely a thing that that I think, I definitely think it surprised me, has surprised me in my own life. It's like, why is all this stuff happening at the same time? I thought we were supposed to have these challenges one at a time.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because I don't know if what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I don't know if that's true, actually. I think a lot of people don't get stronger when something doesn't kill them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I know that sounds a little jaded, but like, I mean, I know for me, like, when I got my diagnosis, I couldn't even think about it. I was kind of like, it was like, I said it in the book, it's like a boil on my butt. Like, it hurts when I sit with it the wrong way, but otherwise, I just don't really think about it. And
Right.
because I had so many other people I was caring for, my mother, my husband, my sons, you know, it was just kind of like it to think that I might develop ALS during all of this, it just wasn't even, it was something that I just kind of pushed away.
I can understand that. I can see that. As an observer, I can see how that would be the path forward. You know, it's like I can only deal with the things that are urgent and emergent right now. And right now,
right.
That part of my life is not on fire. Yeah. So somewhere in here is the choice, that is the shift from the creative writer and musician to an activist of sorts, an ALS activist. And in there, I want to ask, and actually, as I wrote this out, I realized that I didn't have it as a question, but is there an understated choice in here? Because was there an option to not do that? Was there a choice to just go through your life and not turn in to the person who became an activist?
Well, you have to back it up a little bit because when my kids were small, I was already an activist.
Okay.
So I was already doing activism in the Democratic Republic of Congo when my kids were little. So I was already an activist. And I can't say that that ever went away. Like, I think it was in my blood, even though I didn't know it was in my blood. And the women that I met when I was in Congo taught me how to be an activist. And so I had those muscles that I wasn't really using yet.
So let me ask a follow-up question on that so I know more about that experience. So there's a time where you went to the Democratic Republic of Congo and lived there okay, so tell us briefly what that was so that we know that, because that is a surprise to me and I like this.
So I read a book that changed my life, and it basically led me to go to Congo and talk to women and children who were survivors of rape and torture.
Okay.
So I didn't live there. I was there for 11 days for one trip. And then I wrote my book, Unnatural Resources, based on that experience. And then I went back again to see how people were doing. And so I made friends with like child soldiers and people who were forced to be, like they who were trafficked, they're victims of human trafficking. And I learned a lot about the resilience of women, especially in a place where it's like the hardest place to be human, much less a woman. It's a horrible place to be a woman. And so yeah, while I was going through all of this other like ALS and cancer and like the kid falling apart, I was publishing my first novel. So like, and then I got the genetic, I mean, it's crazy to even think about what was happening then. Like, I look back at those times and I'm like, how did I actually do that? So yeah, but I wasn't, I don't know. I knew that when I received the diagnosis of being a genetic carrier, that I was going to be using the muscles I learned in Congo, and I was going to become an advocate for patients' rights. And it just wasn't even a decision I made. It was sort of just, I mean, I could have chosen not to take the genetic test and been like, see no evil, hear no evil, and all the stuff. But I just think that if you find out something horrible, then you know that there's something to do about it. But if you're just worried that something horrible might happen, then you're kind of just like Woody Allen, like fluttering your hands and being like, oy vey, this might happen, So it's like, if you throw down the gauntlet and face the thing, the chances are you're going to win. But if you ignore the thing, then you're going to lose.
All right. So for you, then it sounds to me like the choice to be an advocate or an activist is something that you see as just being a part of you. That was the natural next step. And then you've gone on to participate in research studies, longitudinal studies. You've testified before the FDA. You speak and you've written a book about this. I want to talk for a second about support because we've talked about all the things that were going on. You said that when you look back on your life, you were writing this book, you wrote another book, you're not sure, and it's hard to imagine how you got all these things done. I think for everybody who's watching and listening, the pressure and the strain that you must have been on, it is immense, huge. You were supporting your husband, you were supporting your kids, you were supporting your mom. I believe it's at one point you're also supporting your stepdad as he goes through end stage. You have all these accomplishments. The question I have is, who's supporting you?
Well, I was, and my dad was a really great source of love and support. The truth is, my little guy, who was only 12 at the time, he really stepped into a role of like proxy caregiver for me. He really was, and continues to be quite the humanitarian. He's 19 now, and I mean, we're very, very close as a result of going through this together. We were the only two people in the family who could actually like maintain. And so we leaned on each other quite a lot. I think I put a lot of pressure on his little shoulders at the time, and he rose to this role of proxy caregiver to his own mom pretty well.
So that's a beautiful story. I appreciate that. And so there's all of these things. It's, you, when do you decide to write the book Last Nerve? When does that happen?
I was already writing it because it started as a journal. And so, what happens in the book, and you can kind of see it, is that I catch up to myself in my writing. So, like, it's like 2022 or something, and I'm like, I'm sitting here under this tree realizing that this is a book. It's basically like I've been writing this journal, and I'm like, hey, I think I just wrote a book. And it was just so strange because. Because I think I went back to journal entries, and I was like, this is the hero's journey. I'm like, I think this is the hero's journey that I've written. Like this idea of like somebody who overcomes tremendous adversity and becomes better for it, you
So, for
know?
people who are in the audience who may not know it, a lot of people do know it because it's very, very famous. But the hero's journey is a storytelling framework that's, I think, most famous because of screenplays, and you can see it in other places. But it has gone all over places. They use it in advertising. They teach it in, presentations now. It's a very famous thing. Joseph Campbell. There's a book you can buy, The Art of Storytelling, I think, is what it's called, or The Art of Screenplay. I forget what the name of his book is, but yeah, The Hero's Journey. So there's a difference between writing a book and then publishing a book, right? Because you can write it and stick it in your bedside drawer and and not do anything with it. Take me back to the decision-making process of you, because it is not everybody writes a book about their family, and it's a special journey. What were your thoughts about publishing a book about your journey and your family's journey through this? What were your motivations and your desires as you looked at that?
So what happened was I went to testify before the FDA, and this is like maybe in 2022 or something. And there were questions like, well, you're on drugs to prevent ALS, right? And I'm like, no, like no one's ever thought to do that. Like we've been talking about that in this group of ours, but no. And let me back up a little bit. Before when I got my genetic results, there was no place to go with this information. So I went looking online for organizations that mentioned genetic ALS, and there were like maybe two or three. And so a bunch of us got together in one of the other groups, and we were like, let's start our own group of genetic carriers of ALS. And we were the first group to ever do that. So I think what I was doing was I was trying to build a framework for other people who are going through something similar, not only through End the Legacy, which is the organization that we started, but also through this book. It's like there are 150,000 people in the US who are walking around with genetic mutations for ALS and they don't even know it. So when they get that genetic information, they're going to have a handbook for it. Like, and so when I was reading back, it wasn't so much, how do I feel about publishing about my family? It was more like, the FDA doesn't realize that, like, we're living with these mutations and we have lives. Like we have husbands and wives and parents and children. And, like, we have lives outside of just being genetic carriers. And I think a lot of times when you go to a research study and you receive a note, and incidentally, the note in advance says, "Dear research participant," which is really, really offensive after you've given like spinal fluid to someone. Like that's not an easy thing to give. And so, you're kind of like, they don't know that I have a life outside of being research participant number 156. And like it started kind of pissing me off a little bit. Like yes, I'm a research participant, but I'm also a sister and a daughter and a wife and a mom, and all these things in my life are falling apart. And like I think a lot of people in midlife, especially women, feel that way. And so it became very clear to me that this book had to be written not just for genetic carriers of ALS and not just for my family, but for people who are going through this insurmountable task of going from somebody who's a reproductive female to being someone who's not reproductive, but is still being asked to give of themselves in the way that a new mother is being asked to give of themselves. And I don't know, I guess I just thought, hell yeah, someone's gonna read this and maybe they won't even wanna know about ALS. Maybe they just wanna know what it's like to go through all this and come out the other side as a stronger person.
No, I love that answer. I think that's that there's a lot there. I think there's a lot of truth in the surprise of being in midlife and all the challenges that come with it. The challenges of being a newborn caregiver are very romanticized and very published, you know, and then the benchmark events of that make it into every rom-com, you know, high school graduation and marriage and all of those things. But the nitty-gritty of, and it is starting to show up, but the nitty-gritty of what life looks like when it's not the highlight reel is a lot, is a lot. And it's helpful to have people tell you that they're all going through it. And one of the things that so I'll put it, I have not had anything like the experience you've had, but after my dad died more than 15 years ago, but I remember being shocked, just gobsmacked that people, you know, I'm going to the grocery store or something, and I'm just gobsmacked that people are going through their days just, you know, walking around. Living their lives, and I'm carrying this enormous, you know, weight of grief. And I was like, "How dare they?" And then I'm like, "Oh, wait a second, Amy. They're just living their lives. They don't even have any idea what you're doing." And then the next thing is, if you think that through, you realize that probably everybody is living a version of that at some point, where they are going through the day-to-day motions of doing the things that there are while huge things are happening inside their life. And that's the lived experience, right? Everybody's doing that. The guy who honks at you in traffic may be having, I mean, maybe he's just annoyed, right? But maybe he's having a really bad day. We just don't, and maybe everything is, you know, stressed out in his life, and we really just don't know. All right, so very good. So you write the book, you to tell this story, it's a wonderful book. I very much enjoyed reading it. You do a nice job. It's told in, now that you told me that it started as a journal, because it's told in a series of like almost short vignettes that bounce through beautiful scenes. Very, very nice. You do have a special offer for the audience, which is an autographed copy of The Last Nerve. There's instructions for how people can redeem that by contacting Mindy through her website and telling her that you heard about it from this show. You have to be in the United States, and if you listen to this 5 years from now, probably don't reach out to Mindy and ask for a free autographed copy. Buy the book and be happy about it, right?
Right.
So, all right, very good. So, anything before we wrap this up with the final questions, what, as somebody who talks about this for like more than all things, ALS is not something that always gets a lot of attention. I remember the Ice Bucket Challenge. And then now I've shared that it is in the news because somebody famous just passed away, a celebrity passed away after living with it. But what is something that you would like to share with people that you wish that they knew about the illness, the families that are living with this? What is something you want to share?
First of all, ALS is considered a rare disease, but 1 in 300 people in the United States alone will be diagnosed with ALS. So it's really not that rare. And chances are that you know somebody who has it. So you should educate yourself about what to expect because a lot of people don't realize. It's a fatal neurodegenerative disease for which there is no cure. And so, yeah, that's sort of an interesting tidbit. It's not that rare.
Not that rare. And while we hope for advancement and research and options and cures and preventative things, like many things, we should all do a better job of educating ourselves and the people in our family to be prepared for these things, in our communities, with the people we love, our neighbors, all of those things. Thank you for sharing that. That was very nice. All right. So, are you ready to wrap this up with my final three random questions?
Sure.
All right. Some people get really nervous about this. Don't be worried. Don't be nervous. All right, here we go. Do you remember what was the first album or cassette or whatever the format was of music that you bought for yourself? Do you remember the band or the artist?
Yes. It was Sean Cassidy's Born Late.
I love that. That's so good. That's
On
so good.
vinyl.
On vinyl. Okay, very cool. Very, very cool. All right, now, next one. Have you ever bought a t-shirt or other merch at a live performance of any kind? So I wasn't sure where we were going to be with like the music thing when I wrote this question. So it could be anything. It could be a Broadway show, a concert, a kids fundraising performance. But any type of merch that you ever bought at a live performance, and share it with us, and whether you still have it and wear it.
Yeah, I just went to a show a couple months ago. I bought a concert t-shirt when I saw the Flaming Lips.
Very cool. Very, I love it. That's a lot of fun. Okay, the Flaming Lips. That's super fun. All right, so now here we go. This is a more contemporary thing. The Winter Olympics just ended. And so my question here is, how do you feel about the sport of curling? Do you love it, can't stand it, or you don't pay any attention at all, and therefore you have no feelings?
I'm so glad you asked because I just saw this meme go around on Instagram of Italian women curling with a broom, and they're like cleaning the steps outside of a church. I thought it was hilarious. Curling, you know, it's funny. I actually did watch it, and I was wondering about their shoes that they wear. Like they have special curling shoes. Did you know that? I mean, I guess I'd call myself curling curious.
Curling curious. We're going to coin that phrase here today. I too wondered about the shoes because the curling coverage was ubiquitous and unavoidable in my house. It seemed like I couldn't get away from it. Every time I turned on the TV, I was like, how much curling could there possibly be happening? So, but yes, absolutely. I did wonder about the shoes. They are distinct. I cannot pretend that I understand them, but we did have a pointless conversation in my house where we all pretended to have any information at all about the curling shoes. And that really did happen in my life. And people in the audience can reach out and share with me their curling stories. That's it. Mindy Erlob, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obviously, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.